Maybe you forgot that we were in the series of Job. It's been a while since we got to it, but let me just backtrack a little bit. You will remember that Job lost all his possessions, lost his family, then was tried by his friends, and now God is speaking to Job. We're in chapters 38 through 39. And in the last message, we talked about God speaking to Job from inanimate creation. And I suppose if I were to summarize Job 38 through 39, it would be like this. God speaking, "So Job, you think I count you as my enemy, and I am far removed from your problem." I wonder, maybe somebody here this morning said, that's how I feel. I feel like God is, I'm his enemy and he's far removed from me. But this is what I think it says. "I am not your enemy. I love you with an everlasting love. I care about your problems and I am able to fix up all your problems, but you have a few things to learn." From inanimate creation, you should be able to see that I know every last thing about you and I care about every last little thing. Now I want to show you a few things about myself from animate creation, from the animal world. Excuse me. And as I see the book, when God is done showing Job how much he knows and how much he cares, then he goes about to show Job what is the problem. The book of Job is written like a good novel. It builds up a plot and builds it up until almost at the end of the story, and then the plot is revealed and everything ends and Job lives happily ever after. That's the story of Job. Now let me say a few words about that. If it pleases the purposes of God, then life may not end up living happily ever after, even if you trust him. It may end up in death. But if it should end up in death, in the midst of it all, I can fully trust God that he knows and cares about every last part of my life. In Hebrews chapter 11, we have a host of victorious Christians who conquered by faith and then live to enjoy the victories. But in the last part of the chapter, it gives a number of those who did not accept deliverance, and they died by faith, so that they might inherit a better resurrection. It says some were stoned, some were sawn in two, their life of faith ended in faith. Now I want to give you an example of that, and why do I do this? Because not every story ends like Job, and I don't want anybody to leave thinking if I will only walk with God right, my life will be end up living happily ever after. Just because one lives right does not mean God is obligated to have us live happily ever after. We have proof of that from the life of John the Baptist, who lived a godly life of self-sacrifice. He sacrificed a normal married life. He sacrificed the comforts of a nice home. He sacrificed making friends with men like Herod, who was the ruler, by making an enemy out of him and bringing the truth to that man. And then one day he was thrown in prison. Here is a man who lived for God. And in prison, he sent two of his disciples to Jesus, and he said something like this. "All right, Jesus, are you truly the Christ? And if so, why is my life being wasted in this prison?" You say, just a minute, didn't say that. Well, that's what I think he is. "Why is my life being poured out here for nothing in this prison if you are really the Christ? All my life I've given to proclaiming you, and here I am in this dungeon. And if you are not the Christ, do we wait for another?" And Jesus sent back and he said, "You tell John the things you see, miracle after miracle, the blind see, the deaf hear. You tell him what you see, and oh, by the way, Anybody know what he said after? You tell John, blessed is the man who is not offended in me. I want you here this morning, and you are offended in God. Because he shouldn't have let this happen in your life. He shouldn't let this be like this. And you're offended. Oh, John, by the way, blessed is the man who is not offended in me. And not long thereafter, they came to get John out of prison. And they cut off his head. And John was a man who lived by faith. Not every story ends like Job. Job is going to end up living happily ever after. I tell you all this so that no one gets the false hopes that if you live right, God will bless your life with wealth or long life or a life partner or whatever else you may think you need. You can find victory whether you live or die. But though some life stories do not have a happy ending like John the Baptist, yet Job's story ends up living happily ever after. However, right where we are in the story of Job, he is undergoing fiery trials. God has shown him from inanimate creation that he can take care of Job's problems and that he knows all about him. He cares all about him. Let me ask you this question this morning. Do you think God knows every last little minutest detail about your problem and that he is very concerned about it? Do you think that? Or do you think he's way over there? Well, he's concerned about all these other people, but not me. So we're looking at point C continued, his trying by God. And so Job chapter 38, verse 39, been read for us before. We come to question number one, and it is, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Anybody here know this morning how many young lions are out there that are hungry in Africa, wherever the lions are? Anybody know? You don't know. They're hunting for food and their young ones are lying there with their tummies growling. Anybody here care? Anybody here care how many lions there are like that? God knows, and God cares. He cares. And God sees to it that they are fed. This is true. Listen, this is true of every insect, every reptile, every beast, every fish, and every bird. I was just reading A.W. Tozer this week. You know what he said? The trouble with most Christians is their God is too small. Their God is too small. He said you can't scare a Christian who knows how big God is. Just look at the very next verse, verse 41. Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? This worthless bird, who cares for it? Who hears its young cry for food? God hears, and God answers. Job, did you think I count you as my enemy? Job. Who is it that provided you with all you had? Now turn with me to Luke chapter 12 in the New Testament. Luke chapter 12. The Lord Jesus is going to enlighten this subject. Luke chapter 12, verses 6 through 7. Let me read verses 4 through 5 as well. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more they can do. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after he has killed has power to cast into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 copper coins and not one of them is forgotten before God? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. You see, every sparrow, every swallow, every moose, every worm, every fish, every insect, when it dies, who cares? God does. He knows and He cares. You say, how do you know He cares? Look at verse 6. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 farthings and not one of them is forgotten before God? A little sparrow, not one of them is forgotten before God. Matthew says every time one of them falls, He sees it. God sees. Sparrows were cheap. They were cheaper by the dozen. According to Matthew, pool, a farthing was 1/10 of a Roman penny. You buy 2 sparrows. The sparrow was a small bird that the Jews used for food. Here they are cheaper by the dozen, and over there is a cat that has caught a sparrow, and who cares? God does. God cares. Jesus makes an application to life from this fact. Look at verse 7, chapter 12, verse 7. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. From the fact that God cares about the sparrow and which has almost no value, Jesus makes this application. Fear not, you are worth as much as a sparrow, right? You're worth as much as a sparrow. And He cares about, no, you are worth more than sparrows. So if He cares for the sparrow, what does He think about you? From this, Jesus draws this truth that every hair on our head is numbered. That's not a big job for some of us, right? It's a big job for others. You know, you know what that means? Every time one of those falls out, He knows. Have you thought about that? And so in our verse, God is saying something like this: Job, who hears the cry of the raven and its young? And from the fact that God hears and cares, Job should have made the application that if God cares about that, this worthless bird and hears its cry, do you think, Job, that I have not heard your cry? And maybe you're here this morning and you say, God has not heard my cry. Question number 3, back to Job 39:1-4. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring, their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they depart and do not return to them. Now I think that the question here is not of whether Job knows when the wild mountain goats or the deer give birth. He will have known the general time just like we do. I think the question here is, do you know every time one of them gives birth? Do you know what it's like for them in the time of travail out there on the mountains? No, you don't even know where they are. Jameson Fawcett and Brown comment like this: even wild beasts, cut off from all care of man, are cared for by God at their seasons of greatest need. It may be the Lord is saying something like this to Job: Job, when the mountain goats or deer give birth, you pay not the slightest heed to it, but I am there every time. Every last time. I am there and I care for them. Do you think, Job, that one of them travails and then complications set in that I am not there or that I couldn't care less? And from this, Job should have asked himself and say, how can I actually think I am God's enemy when He cares for the animals on the mountains? When He cares for everything else, how can I think that God doesn't care for me? Question number 4, verses 5 through 8. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made in the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches every green thing. Job, there is the donkey that can be tamed, and there is the donkey that is free from the bondage of man, and you can't tame him. Who set him free? Who made him like this? Who made him so that no man can tame him? You can't bring him into submission to yourself. You just can't do it. You know, it's an incredible thing. I've been to places where they have these big whales, and they've tamed them. Then they tell you what the whale is going to do, and then the whale does the very thing they tell you it's going to do. They tell the whale to do it, it doesn't. Here's this animal they can't tame. You can't tame it. And Job, God talks to Job about it. And so God says something like this, Job, how is it that you are subject to circumstances? Who is ultimately in control of your circumstances and brings you into submission through them? Who is this? You are not able to overcome things yourself. Why are you like that, Job? Is it not because I have made you like this? Question number 5, 9 through 12. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bring the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him when his strength, because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? So God is asking Job about the wild ox. Can you tame him? Well, you can't. Then he goes on to the ostrich in verses 13 through 16. By the way, why is the wild ox like that? Why is the tame ox like this and the wild one like this? Why is it? Because God made them like that. 9 through 12, then 13 through 16. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are there her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? For she leaves her eggs on the ground, warms them in the dust, and she forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern, because God deprived her of wisdom, and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. So God asked Job to consider the ostrich and how she is different from the stork. And then this bird. The ostrich is not a very bright bird. It says it lays its eggs in the sand and doesn't give thought that some beast may come and step on the eggs. And then she pays no mind to her young when they are born. Now, you may have heard about the ostrich, that when it senses danger, it sticks its head in the sand. I checked Encyclopedia Britannica, and they say that it is a legend. It's not true. And we've all heard the saying, I'm sure. But they said what the ostrich does, when danger comes, it will lay itself out flat on the ground. And I guess maybe that's where the idea of sticking the head in the sand comes from. Will lay itself out flat on the ground and hope that nobody can see it. Now, I don't know, but maybe God is saying, Job, why do you hurt so terribly over losing your children? Why do you hurt so over losing your possessions? Is it not because I have made you like that? Is it not because I have made you like that? If I had made you like the ostrich, I wouldn't even be able to get your ear from these things. But now I've made you like this, and when you lose your possessions, you're listening. I can get your ear. Question number 7, verses 19 through 25. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. The Lord now speaks to Job about the war horse. Now, not any horse makes a war horse. Some years ago, we went to see the Lipizzaner stallions. The Lipizzaner horses are war horses. And they know no fear. When the clash of war gets loud, they just go. it just gets them excited to go. Why does one horse act like this and another one like this? By the way, why are you the way you are? Is it not so? Because God has made us like that. Question number 8, verses 26 through 30. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crack of the rock and the stronghold. And from there it spies out the prey, its eyes observe from afar, its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So look at the hawk or the eagle. I made them the way I made them to equip them to do what they do. They dwell high in the crag of the rocks, and I give them wings to obtain to that. But not only that, I give them eyes so they can see from there to over there. I, by the way, Job, I have equipped you for what you need. I think Job has got to say, I have equipped you for what you need. I made you. Is there anybody here that has an excuse for not living by faith in the Lord Jesus Christ? No, God has made us the way He made us so that we would be able to do those things. So God's lessons for Job to this point come to an end as I see it. God has told Job that yes, He knows all about Job's troubles, and it is not that He does not care for Job. It is out of His great love and care that He has let everything happen to Job that has happened to him. Job is not His enemy. He is the center of His love. So chapter 40, let's read verses 1 and 2 to chapter 40. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. So I think this chapter says something like this. So Job, we have come to the end of our lessons from animate and inanimate creation. So now, shall the one who contends with the Almighty, who's that? Who's the one who contends with the Almighty? Job. Shall the one who contends with the Almighty now correct him, please? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. God had said earlier, I will question you and you shall answer me. And now he will wait no longer. Job must answer. So Job, you who had all the ideas, why don't you now correct me? Now let's look at the first part of Job's answer. But before we do that, let me remind you of a few things he said earlier. In chapter 31, 35 through 37, Job said this, oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me. That's what I want. I want to talk to him. And that mine adversary had written a book. Surely I would take it upon my shoulder and bind it as a crown to me. I would declare unto him the number of my steps. As a prince, I would go near to him. See, I would go to him and I would say, Lord, this is the way it is. Now I want you to look at chapter 40, verse 4. Then Job answered verse 3, the Lord, and said, behold, I am vile. I am vile. The text literally reads, I am light. Once he thought himself to be a weighty man. I wonder, we have those here. And now he has seen God and he said, I am light. And so he says, who shall answer you? I don't know what to say. Then comes his second statement. I lay my hand over my mouth. What did he say earlier he would do? You just give me a chance to talk to you and I'll set my case straight before you. Now he says, and why does he do that? He is saying, Lord, you have silenced me. I have nothing to say. But you know what? God wanted him to have something to say. But he doesn't get it yet. Job is not, God is not yet done with Job. Job does not yet know the problem. He has only now become silent. Job says, once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. Job had wished for a hearing with God, and now he has been in the presence of God, and he is silenced. The next time he talks to God, you can read ahead if you want to. The next time he talks to God, he will have something to say. God would like to hear more, and he will, after he has exposed Job to the problem. And we're going to see that. I'm not sure what the next message will be, but in the next message will come what I believe is the heart of the book of Job. The very heart of it. And so in conclusion, what has happened so far? Well, from inanimate creation, God has shown Job that he knows everything going on in Job's life and that he is not unjust. He is there and he cares. As he sees to the needs of the young lions, as he provides for the raven, as he knows about the wild goats, the deer and deer bear their young, and he cares, how much more does he care for Job, and much more does he care for every person here this morning. As the rest of the animate world performs that which it was created to do, so God wants man to bring forth that which he created him to do. It is not for Job to instruct the Creator. It is for the Creator to instruct Job. How does all that apply to us? Listen, I want to ask you this morning, do you think God knows all about you? You say, yeah, I know he knows everything. Well, do you really think he knows all about you? Do you think he knows every problem? Do you think he knows everything that is happening? Do you think he knows what kind of cells you are carrying in your body and what they're going to do 5 years from now? Do you think he knows all this? I want to read for you something that I copied from a videotape done by Creation Research Institute. The speaker, I believe, was Ken Ham. I've used this over the years when I teach man, sin, and salvation. And I want to read you. I listened to the tape and I copied this down. Listen to this. Our bodies contain about 30 trillion cells. Anybody know how much is 30 trillion? Huh? Our bodies contain about 30 trillion cells. Inside each cell is a little porous bag called a nucleus. It contains millions of components right in this little sphere. A microbiologist friend of mine has likened that nucleus to what's as complex as the city of Tokyo. There are millions of components. Now, let me just say something. You know what the scientists said not too many years ago when they discovered the cell? They called it the simple cell. Now they say the cell is as complex as the city of Tokyo, and I say, I wonder if they've found it all yet. Some of them are producing things, some are consuming things. There are electrical and chemical messages that are going back and forth, sometimes millions per second. Listen, 30 trillion cells, millions of messages per second while we're sitting here. It is very, very complex. In fact, that nucleus is almost a miniature universe in itself. But the most interesting thing, in my opinion, are the 23 pairs of chromosomes that you have. You have one set of 23 from your father, one set of 23 from your mother. They're all curled up and scrunched up together like little springs. If we could take those springs and stretch them out, there would be a long, skinny strand about 7 feet long. But when we stretch it out, it would become so thin you couldn't even see it under an electron microscope. But if we could take a little piece of that and magnify it 100 million times, you magnify this thing 100 million times, it would become about this thick, 100 million times. Now there's a fantastic amount of information coded on this long 7-foot strand as we see it, a fantastic amount. That information determines, for example, what you look like, and that explains, doesn't it, why I'm so good-looking. And if you know Ken Ham, you know why he say that, because he doesn't look so good. Anyway, he said that's like all these explain why we look the way we do. Explains why you are the way you are too. It's like a computer program. It tells every cell in your body how it is to operate from the very instant you're conceived until the day you die. It's a marvelous piece of information. Now let's consider just how much genetic material you have in your body. Sometimes this material goes by the name of DNA or the nucleic acid or the genetic material or the genes, all means about the same thing. But let's consider the following. You see this 7 foot long tape here. Inside each cell is a strand. If you stretch it out, it will stretch out about 7 feet, but you can't see it unless you magnify it a couple million times. How long do you think it would become if we hooked all 30 trillion cells together? Here's one person here. You hook, take all 30 trillion cells, you hook... Well, anybody here want to guess? How far would it go? You think it would stretch across the United States? You think it would go around the Earth? It would go from here to the moon over 100,000 times. Now, let's consider the following. If we scooped up all that DNA that would stretch from here to the moon over 100 million times, it would not fill 2 teaspoons. Listen, this is all going on in our bodies right while we sit here. Remember, it's very, very thin. Now let's look at it another way. You see this 7 foot long tape. If we reduce that information that's stored on that tape, very densely stored information, it would fill a very rich library of over 4,000 volumes. Can you picture 4,000 volumes? Can you picture 4,000 books? Can you picture them here on the stage? Picture this stage now lined, say maybe 8 feet high and across from that side of the building to this side of the building, and I have something like 4,000 volumes. You've got that much information crammed into every single cell in your body. By the way, the information on the cells tells you that evolution can't happen. You've got that much information crammed into every cell of your body, and every cell has a duplicate set of those 4,000 volumes. Now I want you to think big. See these 4,000 books? How big a room do you think it would take if we were to reduce all 30 trillion cells of your body to their 4,000 book equivalent? Do you think it would fill this auditorium, or say this whole church? You don't think it would? Who has an idea how big a room it would take? I know many of you have been to the Grand Canyon. If I were to reduce every cell to its 4,000 book equivalent, it would fill this Grand Canyon to overflowing 40 times. I don't know if we can get a picture how big that is. And you probably don't have a good feel, he says, for how big the Grand Canyon is. Sure, it's about a mile deep. It's several miles wide, maybe from 3 to 20, depending on where you're standing. But it stretches out laterally for 200 miles, and you could fill it up over 40 times, and that would be the information that's secluded in your cells in your body. You have got a fantastic amount of information built into your body. You are intricately designed. You are extremely complex. Now here's my question, who made it all like that? And do you think God knows every cell in your body? Do you think He knows if you are carrying cancer cells? Did not Jesus say that He counts every hair on our head? I was reading A.W. Tozer recently. He said, remember that God is enthusiastic about His works. God is not an absentee running His world by remote control. The Scripture says that He is upholding all things by the word of His power right now. Upholding all things. That's all the cells. That's everything that exists everywhere. The presence of the invisible God in the universe makes things run. God is the perfect creator, and He runs everything by being present in His works. This is what Tozer says. That's all through the prophets, that's all through the Psalms, and that's all through the book of Job. All through the Old Testament. And so I ask you this morning, do you think that God cares about you? I know we would say yes. I mean, do you really think He cares about you? Or do you think he has programmed you with certain kinds of diseases and cells, and now he sits back and he just lets it go? Does he care for every sparrow that falls to the ground? Does he feed the lion cub or the young raven? And if the wild donkey and wild ox, the ostrich, the horse, the hawk, the eagle do that which they were created for, why would we not do that which we are created for? And what is that? It is to glorify God by trusting Him in everything. And God will see to it that every person here gets every opportunity to trust Him. We will find difficult circumstances. Could you commit everything in your life to a God who knows all 30 trillion cells in your body and He cares about every last one of them? Could you commit yourself to a Creator who made you for Himself? See, that's what God is looking for. How about this morning, bowing before God and saying, you know what, Lord? I trust you. Whatever it is here, I trust you. I want to close. I want to give us one moment to do that. To just say, Lord, I guess I needed to be reminded. You're far bigger than I ever gave you credit for. And I can commit and trust myself to you. I'm going to give you one moment. We'll close. And may the Lord bless. And may we learn to live in trust all the days of our life. You know what I have come to? I have come to many points when I wish the trials of this life would end. And it is not to be so until we meet Him. We have to learn to trust in every place where we are. May God bless us to that.